Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Leaders in History, today on Advanced. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to another Advanced Studio Classroom. You're joining my co-host Peter and I, my name is Simon, in the studio for the second part of our June books lesson. Peter, what's it called?
It is called The Lessons of History. Our article is called The Lessons of History, How the Study of History Contributes to Good Leadership.
Now, we used a couple of English idioms yesterday to sort of guide our discussion. We talked about history repeating itself, which basically means things that happen in history happen over and over again throughout the course of time. We also talked about history rhyming, meaning, well, it doesn't exactly repeat. There's connections. And then you gave us an idiom that you're going to have to restate it, because yours was yours was long.
Yeah, mine's a little bit longer. It's the past is not dead. In fact, it's not even past.
Okay.
And again, I don't have a source for that. Possibly the American science fiction author Philip K. Dick, but someone like that, I think. Someone maybe a
Some guy said this thing at one point, and it is useful for our understanding today, because it basically means the past influences what is happening now.
Right.
That's kind of the idea.
Even though we might be tempted to think that it doesn't, that there's nothing but the present moment, only, you know, just be here now. But no, we always have to reckon. We have to take into account what has happened in the past.
Now, yesterday in our lesson, we were introduced to a professor, somebody named Frank Gavin, who comes from, Johns Hopkins University. I'm a Canadian, so I have no idea. I feel like that's in Maryland somewhere.
Baltimore.
Yeah, Baltimore, Maryland. Baltimore is in Maryland?
That is the city.
I'm so glad you're here, Peter. If you weren't here, we might have had that whole thing in the wrong state. Anyway,
oh, goodness.
Good stuff. So Johns Hopkins. Johns Hopkins it's kind of famous for its medical school, right?
Yes, yes. It's a highly regarded school across the board, but particularly for medicine.
They teach other things too, though. Like, clearly they have this center where people are basically studying like foreign policy and statecraft, sort of policy, if you will, government policy. And so this is where Frank Gavin teaches. It seems he's a history professor. We learned yesterday a little bit about him. We learned he's kind of an ideal professor, kind of interesting. He's smart. He asks good questions. He's quick-witted, so he's kind of funny and quick on the uptake of things. He's also kind-hearted. And he has some interesting expertise. Nuclear policy was one of them. International finance was another. And he's taught at a whole bunch of different places. But the reason we were talking about him here is he wrote the book that we're dealing with in this book article. Do you remember what it's called?
Yes, it's called Thinking Historically, A Guide to Statecraft and Strategy.
And it's a fairly new book, right?
Yes, yeah. Came out September 2025. So
at the end of yesterday, we were sort of told that there's this general awareness that history is important for current decision making. Like, people kind of understand the idioms and we're familiar with that idea. But Gavin, that's the family name, obviously, of this professor, was sort of arguing that even though we know that, we often don't use history in our decision-making, and I take it that is the point of the book.
Right,
to encourage us to consider history in making decisions for the future.
Exactly. There's this quote from yesterday that we read where Gavin says specifically, it may seem obvious that we should employ history to improve decision-making, but it is rarely done.
Okay. So, we're going to continue on today. We're actually going to do kind of an interesting breakdown of the article today. If you have your magazine with you, I would encourage you to open it up. If you don't have your magazine, I would encourage you to pause this program and run as quickly as you can to get a magazine, because it is probably the easiest and most convenient way to support our work here at Advanced Radio. Today we're going to do three readings, so we're just going to look at a very short one first, kind of the first paragraph in that lesson for you. Let's get Campbell to do our reading for us now.
His passion project is to persuade policymakers to use history to improve their approach to governing. He also employs historians to make their work more accessible to busy policymakers by avoiding hyper-esoteric subjects and turgid language. He's convinced there has been too little effort to instruct decision makers on how to use history or to train historians on how to engage with the policy world.
All right. Thank you so much, Campbell, for that reading. Basically, we start off here in kind of an awkward way, but that's because we've split this article across 2 days. Normally, we wouldn't start with his. We'd kind of tell you who he is. But hopefully, from our introduction, you know that we're talking about Frank Gavin here, that professor who has written this book. So we learn here about his passion project. Peter, what is a passion project?
Yeah, a passion project is obviously something that you feel passionate about, that means a lot to you. But it also carries the idea that it is something you would do even if you weren't paid for it. Even if it is something you are doing and not being paid for it, just because it means so much to you.
So it could be a job, it could be a hobby, but it's the thing
right.
You care about doing.
Exactly.
You're passionate
yes.
about doing, basically. Okay, so Frank Gavin's passion project is what?
To persuade policymakers, some nice alliteration there, his passion project is to persuade policymakers to use history to improve their approach to governing.
I should say there, listeners, Peter made an allusion to the alliteration in this. Alliteration is the forgotten part of English poetry. Most of you will be familiar with rhyming words because we've been talking about history rhyming with the past, right? Events rhyming with the past. Yep. So rhyming words, they're words that have the same ending sound. Alliteration is words that have the same beginning sound. And we use them in English to create mood. Peter actually gave you a great example there from the writing. Passion, project, persuade, policymakers. So it's a p-p-p sound repeating over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, give it a try in your personal life. And if you write a comment on this program, why not use a little alliteration?
There you go.
To demonstrate your English prowess. That would be a wonderful thing. Okay, so basically what he's trying to do is persuade policymakers to use history. He also implores historians to make their work more accessible to busy policymakers by avoiding hyper-esoteric subjects and turgid language. Oh, Peter.
I know.
I hope you know what those words mean because
oh, do I know?
I'm going to need your help here. The hyper obviously means more than normal, excessively.
Right, right.
Help us out with esoteric.
Yeah, esoteric just means like insider talk, insider language, things that aren't generally known except to people who have spent a lot of time looking at a particular subject.
I would go so far as to say concealed, hidden. Or coded language.
Coded or concealed implies an intention, and I don't think there's really an intention implied in the word esoteric. I think it's a more neutral term that just means things that aren't widely known, very specific knowledge that you would get if you studied a particular field, but not that everybody would just have on their minds.
And okay.
Turgid language, turgid, I love that word too, is just turgid writing or speech is boring, difficult to understand, it's thick, it's just, it may, you know, come from intelligence and it may be communicating legitimate, even important ideas, but just the way the words are put together, the way the ideas are expressed, make it hard to follow. And so turgid is one of the words we use to describe basically poor writing.
Peter, we actually made reference to this idea yesterday. We were talking about how there's a historical method, but neither of us had any idea what it was. So, you know how there's a scientific method, people are familiar with this term, like a set of guidelines and basically rules, procedures, if you will, for how to do science properly. But there is also a set of guidelines for how to do history properly. We just don't know what it is. If you want to hear that program, listeners, actually, there is a thing you can do. Peter, what do they do with our YouTube channel?
Right. Well, you want to subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's just about 220 NT a month. And by subscribing to the channel, you get access to all the past recordings of the discussions of the articles of all the issues going back several years. Whereas if you're not subscribed, you get access to just today's, yesterday's, and I believe the day before. So if you ever want to go back more than 3 days in the history of advanced articles, listen to the discussion of an older article, you want to consider becoming a paid subscriber to the YouTube channel.
You can binge listen. Hours, yes. And hours of advanced programs.
Knock yourself out.
Wonderful. Okay. So if you want to check back and see what we were talking about when we were talking about the historical method, go ahead and do that. Though it isn't strictly necessary. That was yesterday's program.
Right.
And you can still just get that without subscribing to YouTube.
Right.
So.
But to study the history of Advanced Magazine, yeah. You would want to become a paid subscriber.
Okay. So the idea here is we want to make history accessible to the people. Or at least the policymakers and the statespeople. He's convinced there has been too little effort to instruct decision makers on how to use history or to train historians on how to engage with the policy world. I think that's probably true, just given our own, you know, panel ignorance. Of the specifics of how this is done, right?
Sure. And he makes a good point there that he's not just talking about how statespeople and politicians need to be more aware of history. He's also saying, just in that one sentence, how historians who do know history and do study history need to become better able to speak to the policy world, to speak to statespeople and politicians so that they can do their jobs better. It's not a one-way street. He's calling for a two-way street. Of relationship and communication here.
Fair enough. Let's get Campbell to do our second reading. It's our bigger reading because it covers the second section in our article for today. Campbell, take it away.
Historical sensibility. Gavin urges leaders to develop historical sensibility, a temperament that appreciates and embraces life's unpredictable rhythms, baffling surprises, and head-spinning coincidences. Historical sensibility emanates from a tolerance for and appreciation of unintended consequences, stunning reversals, and sheer luck in human affairs. He also urges policymakers to learn to think historically. This requires a set of skills to interrogate the past by probing deeply, constructing and reconstructing chronologies, and contemplating counterfactuals in which different decisions might have significantly altered subsequent events. This may sound abstract, but Gavin offers concrete examples. For instance, former U.S. Federal Reserve Board Chair Ben Bernanke was also a respected scholar of the Great Depression. Gavin argues that as the world unraveled during the 2008 financial crisis, Bernanke drew on his understanding of economic history to grasp the scope of the challenge, recognize the importance of global coordination, and embrace out-of-the-box thinking. The Fed chair's grounding in history liberated him from rigid doctrines and encouraged innovative policy making.
Okay, so we're told here that we're learning about historical sensibility. I'll be honest, when I first looked at this, I thought, wow, that's a lot of turgid language and hypo-esoteric talk. But fortunately, we have Peter here, master of words, to help us wander through this maze of vocabulary. So to start it off, we are urged, I'm saying we because obviously if you're listening to Advanced, you're leader quality, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we as leaders are urged to develop historical sensibility. And then it defines that. What is historical sensibility? Mm-hmm. I guess normally when you have a sensibility, it means you're sensible, practical.
Right,
you have a good grasp of common sense. But what does it mean to have historical sensibility?
Right. Well, sensibility is similar in meaning to that next word, a temperament. A temperament, a sensibility, just means the way in which you think, the way in which you behave, your sensibility, your temperament. And Gavin is urging leaders to develop a temperament that appreciates and embraces life's unpredictable rhythms, baffling surprises, and head-spinning coincidences. So this is tricky. Unpredictable, we don't like things that are unpredictable. They can be fun sometimes, but only if, you know, we're in the mood for it.
It's kind of like the weather report.
Exactly.
You don't really know if it's going to be true.
I suppose. But a baffling surprise, baffling meaning something that you cannot understand, you can't explain it at all. So you're not just surprised by whatever it is, you're also baffled by it. You can't understand it. And head-spinning coincidences.
Would you say baffling is a combination of confusing and shocking?
I would not say shocking. Baffling usually just means something that you cannot make sense of, that you just really just don't know which way is up. Shocking is usually something a bit almost violent or vivid in some way. The words aren't worlds apart, but baffling is usually not quite as intense as shocking. It's just confusing. And so Gavin is urging leaders to develop this historical sensibility is a temperament that appreciates and even embraces the unpredictable aspects of life.
Would you say there's a connection between baffling and head spinning? Sorry to throw all these vocab questions
there,
at you.
Right there in the passage, yeah.
Yeah.
Baffling, head spinning. Head spinning, not necessarily the exact same as baffling. We might say that the events of the past week happened with head spinning speed.
There's
doesn't
definitely
mean we don't understand
more,
them, just means they were very, very fast.
There's more surprise in head spinning than in baffling. Would you say?
I wouldn't actually.
You don't think so?
Head spinning is more amazement. It may have surprise, but not necessarily. Head spin, you can know something that is going to happen, you can understand it, and still have your head spun by how quickly it happens or by how intensely it happens, something like that.
See, I think both baffling and head spinning include elements of surprise or shock, mm-hmm. because I think the idea is you are confused because you have no frame of reference for understanding what is happening.
Yeah, broadly speaking.
Like it's such
that's
a
true.
New situation, new and unexpected event mm-hmm. that you couldn't prepare yourself for the thing you are seeing.
Sure. In a broad sense, that's certainly true. But this is just why we have, you know, three or four different words here to say basically the same thing, because they do have individual nuances.
Okay. So continuing on, as we figure out what historical sensibility is, it tells us it comes from. Oh, it didn't say comes from. They had to use that turgid language. Emanates from, right?
Right.
Which just means comes from. A tolerance for and appreciation of unintended consequences. So that would be my shock part. Mm. Things that are unexpected, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stunning reversals and sheer luck in human affairs. So basically the idea is the reality on the ground is very different from the theoretical model we often create in our heads.
Right.
And historical sensibility isn't so much knowing how to operate in that as knowing to expect that.
Right, right.
So if you've read history, you know that it's not going to happen the way you are planning it.
Yes.
You know there's going to be surprises and unforeseen things happening and confusion and all kinds of problems.
But that there are also things that you can learn from history that may help you deal with unintended consequences, head-spinning coincidences. Because look here in the past, here's someone who was in a similar situation. Here's what they did, and it worked.
Okay.
So it's... Yeah, it's both. It's both understanding that history is not, like we said yesterday, a crystal ball that enables you to predict the future with 100% accuracy, but it does give you some guidelines as to how to deal with things in the present.
Okay. So he also urges policymakers to learn to think historically. Presumably, thinking historically is how you sort of develop the historical sensibility. So what is thinking historically? Well, it basically means you have a set of skills. And what do those sets of skills do?
Right. Well, they interrogate the past, interrogate, like to police officers asking questions of a suspect in a crime.
They analyze, question, explore, learn from.
That's the next word there. Probing.
All these things.
They interrogate the past. It's like they've got the past. They've got history in the questioning room at the police station, and they're interrogating him by probing, exploring deeply, constructing and reconstructing chronologies. Chronology meaning the order in which a series of things happen.
When you probe things, you tend to poke them with like a small stick. So probing tends to be like small, specific areas of exploration to help you form a bigger picture.
Sure. But also a deep exploration. We do probe, you know, one example is with a stick, but there is also a deeper sense in which a probe is to do more than just take a glance at something. It's to really explore it deep.
So if we look at this as a list of skills here, they're probing deeply. So they're exploring, you know, small issues in great detail, and then they're constructing and reconstructing chronologies, which are a chronology is basically a historical timeline,
right?
So here it kind of implies a big picture understanding of what happened and what its effects were. And then contemplating counterfactuals in which different decisions might have significantly altered subsequent events. So counterfactuals here means like if something had been done differently, what would the consequence of that be?
Right. And so, Marvel comic books fans may recall an issue, a book that the company put out many years ago called What If? It would take a important event or pivotal moment in like the history of Spider-Man or the history of the Incredible Hulk and say, remember that story? Well, what if the Hulk had lost that fight instead of winning that fight and spins out a whole new story of the consequences? That's an example of a counterfactual.
Okay, then there's a concession that this might sound abstract, meaning sort of theoretical or separated from reality, but we're given concrete examples. One of those examples involves Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Board chair. He was sort of in charge of the American central banking system during the economic financial crisis of 2008, basically. He's the one who came up with the term quantitative easing, which has done a great deal to lead us to our current economic state. So there we go. Ben Bernanke was also a respected scholar of the Great Depression, which was the last time the U.S. had been through a similar large-scale financial crisis, I assume is the parallel they're drawing here. So as the world unraveled during that financial crisis, when the world is unraveling, it just means all of the systems and norms are coming apart.
Right.
They're no longer holding their form. But despite all of that chaos going on, Bernanke drew his understanding of economic history, drew on it rather, to grasp the scope of the challenge and recognize the importance of global coordination and embrace out-of-the-box thinking. So effectively, he was able to look at what had gone wrong in dealing with the Great Depression and come up with a better way of dealing with this new situation, which had some similarities if it wasn't a repeat.
Right, some rhyming with the Great Depression.
And that brings us to our last reading, Tools and a Checklist. Campbell, help us out.
Tools and a Checklist. Gavin's book provides tools for policymakers to interrogate the past, ask penetrating questions, examine key assumptions, search for pivotal turning points, and consider multi-causal explanations of events and developments. He also offers a historical checklist for leaders as they consider current problems and future strategies. The fundamental questions he believes they should ask include, how did we get here? What else is going on? What are our unspoken assumptions? What is really important? What are the most likely outcomes? What else could happen? How rapid is the pace of events, and is anything inevitable? The longer you can look back, Churchill once said, the farther you can look forward.
Okay, so we're basically told here, you know, okay, let's pause for a second. You know, the problem with all of this is we've been talking about developing this historical sensibility, but we have not actually been told what to do to be historically sensible.
Right, it's been all theory up to this point.
And there is a reason for that. It's because you have to buy the book to get those things, right?
That's first step.
That's effectively what is being said here. So Gavin's book provides those tools for policymakers to interrogate or, you know, explore and probe the past, ask penetrating questions, examine key assumptions, search for pivotal turning points, and consider multi-causal explanations of events and development. So these are, you're going to need tools to achieve all of these things. And if you can achieve all of these things, it will improve your leadership decision-making. That's the understanding here. He also offers a historical checklist for leaders as they consider current problems and future strategies. So there are fundamental questions he believes they should ask. What are those questions, Peter?
Yes, good, all good questions. How did we get here?
Yes.
What else is going on? What are our unspoken assumptions? What is really important? What are the most likely outcomes? What else could happen? And how rapid is the pace of events? And is anything inevitable? We could spend half an hour on almost each of these questions, but that last one, just to clarify, is anything inevitable? Something that is inevitable means it is going to happen. It hasn't happened yet, but it is going to happen no matter what we do in the present.
There's no escaping it.
Yes.
The inevitable. And the question there, of course, is anything inevitable, or can you do something to change these things?
Yes, yes. So more of a philosophical question there, but one that you do want to take into account, certainly.
And we end here with another Winston Churchill quote, just like this article began with. The longer you can look back, one might say the farther, but you can't use the same word twice, right? Because he goes on to say farther. The longer you look back, the farther you can look forward. So the better your understanding of history, the better your ability to deal with the long-term future, I guess.
Absolutely. No matter how it's expressed, I think that essential idea is valuable, and I think this book can help us to better understand that.
Well, thank you, Peter. Listeners, thank you for joining us on our program today. We are at the end of this lesson, but we will have another one. So come on back and join us again for another Advanced Studio Classroom as soon as you can. Until then, I'm Simon.
I'm Peter.
Saying bye for now.
Bye-bye.